OMG, it's Brexit. Yes, Brexit, that thing that we've been talking about for the better part of a year that we never really thought would come to pass. Well, it has happened, and Britain is now in the process of disentangling itself from the European Union, a group of nations it's belonged to for the past 40-plus years. This is a major, major constitutional change for Britain, one that has already led to political upheaval all across that great nation. So thank heaven we have British law professor William Walton here with us for the second week in a row to explain to us not only the political fallout, which was really the subject of last week's interview, but the constitutional implications. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Brexit.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
William Walton is a buddy of mine. He's a professor of law at the University of Northumbria in northeast England. And we've talked to Bill several times, notably about Brexit, about the British exit from the European Union. Indeed, this is the second of two episodes right now that we are having in the aftermath of the pro-Brexit vote. Last week, Bill explained to us the remarkable political fallout, the resignation of a prime minister, the disarray in the Labour Party, the resignation of Nigel Farage, the head of the UKIP party. The extraordinary thing that had been happening there was almost like something significant happened in Washington, D.C. The president resigned. The Senate Majority Leader resigned. Everybody left D.C. and left other people to clean up the mess. That's the sort of thing we talked about last week. This week, we're going to look forward. This week, we're going to focus more on what might happen next with Brexit, because whatever does happen, it's bound to be remarkably significant.
All right, so this it's starting to look like Game of Thrones, minus the swords. But we've had this pivotal event, and then everybody starts running around, resigning, leaving. The parties start to fracture, and it looks like after a period of 2 to 3 weeks, now it looks like Theresa May is going to emerge as the new prime minister. But you've already, as you said, almost damned her with faint praise, because is she just seen as a caretaker now?
No, I don't think she's a caretaker. I think she will certainly lead the party now through to the next election. There is an issue, of course, again, a constitutional issue, as to when that next election should be. Now, it's not unprecedented for a prime minister in office to step down. And not that long ago, you'll remember that Tony Blair did that.
Right.
2007, and Gordon Brown took over. And he pondered about calling a snap election, going to the country, because, of course, you could dissolve Parliament. Then it was part of what we call the royal prerogative, which is that power of the prime minister acting sort of historically under the powers of the king in Parliament. That's hence the term royal prerogative. To one of the powers was to dissolve Parliament and to call an election with the king's consent, or in this case, the queen's consent. But that is normally given. The Queen wouldn't normally refuse the Prime Minister of the day the right to dissolve Parliament and call an election if she thought that it would serve the national interest. Gordon Brown didn't do that in the autumn of 2007. He hesitated. And then he had a very bad winter because of floods and various other things. And the moment of his popularity was lost. And once he lost that popularity, he was clinging on rather than wanting to go to the country.
That's a very important point you're making, is that we're accustomed in this country, at least at the national level, to having very predictable elections on either a 2-year or a 4-year cycle. In Britain, you can dissolve Parliament pretty much any time you want to.
No, I'm shaking my head now.
Okay,
used to be able to.
Correct me. Bring me up to date then. What's going on here?
As part of the coalition agreement with the Liberal Democrats in 2010, the Liberal Democrats have long wanted some constitutional reforms. We've talked about electoral reform and proportional representation. I know your eyes glazed over when I mentioned that. But another thing that they were keen on was removing this royal prerogative of allowing the Prime Minister this executive power to dissolve Parliament. So part of the coalition deal of 2010 was that they brought in a bill which was passed in 2011, and it's a fixed Parliamentary Fixed Term Act, I think it's called, which is requires that essentially we have fixed term parliaments of 5 years, okay. Very much the same way that you do.
So where are you in your current 5-year election cycle?
Well, we had the election last May, didn't we? Or May of 15 months ago.
15, so, right. So this means that...
We're up to 2020 now. So we're on the 2015 to 2020 election cycle.
Right. So whoever is next, Theresa May could be prime minister for the next 4 years then.
That's right. In order to have an election now, Parliament would have to agree, not the prime minister. So it's the legislature which would have to agree, not the executive. And you can see, as I'm sure, as a constitutional lawyer, that's quite a significant change in constitutional powers. So there is a provision as a safety valve, should something happen, you know, a national emergency, for Parliament to agree to dissolve Parliament and have a new election. But it's not in the gift of Theresa May or whoever the Prime Minister is, so which it used to be, until 4 or 5 years ago.
Right, until quite recently then.
So assuming that we are not going to have an election, but that's by no means certain. I mean, it's possible because Brexit is so fundamental, we don't really know what's going to happen.
So we might actually have Parliament vote to dissolve itself, so now we'll go back to a general election, and then we don't know what will happen.
It's possible. And if that happens, that could happen in autumn.
Well, I think that all this discussion we've been having then sort of, you know, once you understand just how fundamental these changes will be and how fundamentally the British political system is reacting, or I should say recoiling from this, now you begin, or at least I think I begin to understand why Article 50 has not been invoked. But let's talk about that. That is the next logical step. If, in fact, Brexit is to occur, isn't that the next thing that Britain needs to do is invoke Article 50?
That's right. So it's Article 50, I think, of the Lisbon Agreement, the Treaty of Rome of 1957, as amended through various iterations, and the Lisbon Agreement, which is one of these European Union treaty amendments. And it was introduced, I think, maybe in anticipation of Britain or one or more countries might eventually leave. And what it says is it's very much in the gift of the member state to leave. So it says that should a country want to leave, then that country must initiate this Section 50 process, Article 50 process, which would have to be complete within 2 years. And it's essentially a two-year divorce process. Now, the big issue, of course, for the United Kingdom is, and again, I think we discussed this in one of your previous programs, was that the Norway model that's sometimes used is de facto, de jure, you leave the European Union, but de facto, you might want to retain many of the benefits, in particular, the single market, access to the single market. Now, that's the access to this barryless market of 500 million people. But in order to gain access, which is, of course, a privilege, which is afforded by the European Union. So when I say access, I mean access without trade restrictions, without duties, import tariffs, import restrictions, and so on, any trade restrictions. The European Union would only do that, as I've done with Norway, in return for... Well, hang on a moment. You've got to accept free movement of labour, and you contribute to the European budget, and you also accept many of the European rules and regulations, which de facto, you look at it and you think, well, hang on a moment. What's the difference between then being a member of the European Union and not being a member of the European Union?
In non-technical terms,
sure.
This basically looks like Britain, up till quite recently, was part of this thing called the EU, and this thing called the EU, the major benefit it provided is free trade with this market of 500 million people with few or no barriers, access to that market, and the cost.
And that's free trade, sorry, just to cut across, that's free trade for goods and services.
Goods and services. Yep. So, I mean, young Britons can go and live in Paris and work there very freely, rather like a young U.S. citizen can go and, you know, leave New York and go to California and work. So huge amounts of benefits and economic vitality and all sorts of cross-cultural benefits. But the costs, the primary costs, were that there was the free movement of people that led to a significant net increase in immigration coming into Britain. And there were also concerns more generally about sovereignty and loss of control to Brussels. And so what the Brexiteers are proposing, the people who were in favor of exiting, was that Britain go ahead and invoke Article 50, begin the two-year process, but then negotiate a deal that would get rid of all the stuff they didn't like, the immigration notably, but keep the stuff that they like, which is the free access to the markets.
Well,
is
yes
that,
and no.
Is that gonna, okay, tell me. Tell me how I got correct. That wrong.
There's an issue here about the sequence of events as to whether you negotiate first and then Article 50. Mm-hmm. That would be what the Brexiteers would want. They said, look, we'll negotiate, because during the referendum campaign, they were saying we will be able to negotiate a great deal for Britain. Mm-hmm. And Britain will have all the benefits, but not the downside, or many of the benefits, not the downside. Plus, of course, we'll have the benefit of once again engaging with the much wider world, India and Brazil, right, the up-and-coming economies, in a way which is more difficult now with the European Union. The Remain people said, this is cloud cuckoo land. If you leave the European Union, you won't get these benefits. You will only get these benefits of access to the single market if you're prepared to accept what you regard as the disadvantages, you know, the free movement of labor, et cetera.
And that's what, and so that's what Norway has done. It's not technically part of the EU, but it's accepted the bitter with the sweet.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And the exit people said, look, we'll be able to negotiate a better deal than Norway, because to go back to the analogy earlier on, if North Dakota were to leave the United States, who would notice? Whereas if California to leave the United States.
Sorry, all you North Dakotans who are listening, but go on, please.
whereas if the California or Texas were to leave the United States, you know, they're in a more powerful bargaining position because mm-hmm. their economies are much stronger. So the issue really is as to whether we negotiate a good deal now and then invoke Article 50. But the European Union has said, no, if you're going to leave, you leave now, and then we'll do the negotiating later on. And, of course, at that stage,
with a two-year clock running.
And you may not get a good deal. And again,
In fact, let me interrupt. From what I've been seeing, Angela Merkel and the other Europeans are saying you're not going to get Norway's deal without paying the price Norway has. I mean, you're not going to get this better deal that you think you're going to get. Is that correct?
That's correct. The European Union, the Juncker and the other senior members of the European Union, have a vested interest in making exit difficult for Britain, making it costly.
Good. That's the reason that they want to discourage Frexit and Pexit and Brexit. And if they make
In Holland, for example, there's a great deal of anti-European sentiment. There's understood to be anti-European sentiment, believe it or not, in Poland, which is, of course, a country that's just come into the European Union and has probably been a net beneficiary in terms of European grant funding, etc. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there's resentment of the European Union. And there is resentment probably in most European countries to a certain extent. But in certain countries, it's quite significant. If you want the project to continue, and which presumably the captains of the project, they have a vested interest in that. Schulz and Juncker, the two that I'm thinking of in particular, then you don't want to make it easy for Britain, because in that case, it may be Poland or Holland next. So in other words, you're going to have to accept free movement of labor, or you're going to have to accept some free movement of labor. You're going to have to accept all or some payment of your pre-existing budget contributions. You're going to have to accept some or all of the existing regulations and new regulations that may come along in environment and consumer protection and so on. And so to an outsider looking at it, they may say in 5 years' time, if they didn't know who was or wasn't a member of the European Union and you just looked at it, you may say, well, Britain's engagement relationship doesn't seem to be that different from France's or Germany's. So we don't know, because this is uncharted water.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with University of Northumbria law professor William Walton about the, as he calls it, the uncharted water into which the UK has now struck out in the aftermath of Brexit. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll return and speak some more with Bill Walton. Stick around.
Comma, down, doobie-doo, down, down. Breaking up is hard. to do. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then I'll be blue. 'Cause breaking up is hard to do.
Time once again for a constitutional quiz with the quiz guy, also known as Doug Smith. What's your title again?
I am the vice president for the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
I love it when you say that. I just love to hear it. It just rolls off your tongue.
It just rolls off my
tongue.
It just
rolls off your tongue. Do you have a quiz today?
I do have a quiz. We're going to be talking Fourth Amendment today.
Fourth Amendment. Do we have somebody on the phone who knows about the Fourth Amendment? Do you have anybody on the...
A little.
Who are you, sir?
My name is Joseph Needle. I'm a student at the University of Maine at Farmington.
The University of Maine. You know Jim Melcher, don't you?
I do. I took one of his classes.
And you listen to this.
Law.
You listen to this class, this podcast, this show in Jim Melcher's class, didn't you?
Yep.
Tremendous. Well, now I know why you are a fan. Please do give my regards to Jim. He's been on the show several times, and he is a wonderful fellow.
I certainly will.
Tremendous. All right, Doug, we've got a scholar, so make sure it's a tough question.
Can I just say, I know why public radio stations throughout the United States of America love this show.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you lower the average listener age for them. It is great. How many students and law students and college students listen to this show
week after week? And, you know, you are actually touching upon a very serious subject. Public radio, NPR listeners, for example, skew old. I mean, some of them are almost as old as I am. They do. And this is really something. And radio generally does not attract a lot of young people. But a lot of young people are listening to this show, either on the radio or via podcast. So, yes, we are responsible for the continued survival of public radio.
I think it's you are bringing hordes.
You are, too. Back at you, buddy. Back at you.
Here we go. I've got a question.
All right.
And I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
Joseph, you ready?
Yep. Ready.
Okay,
here comes the question. Let's talk Fourth Amendment, searches and seizures. The recent case of U.S. versus Rocky Joe Houston illuminates the clash between privacy and technology. Why did the federal court rule that no warrant was needed to watch Rocky Joe Houston from a camera mounted on a telephone pole near his house for 10 months straight?
Whoa. A court ruled that...
Why did the Federal Circuit Court rule that no warrant was needed for prosecutors to watch Rocky Joe Houston from a camera mounted on a telephone pole near his house for 10 months straight?
What? Oh my gosh, do you have some answer choice?
I do. Here comes number one, or A, rather. Cops only need a warrant if surveillance by video is longer than 11 months.
Mm.
B, Rocky Joe, and I really just like saying his name.
Rocky Joe.
Rocky Joe Houston. B, Rocky Joe may have been a domestic terrorist, triggering a suspension of constitutional rights.
Oh, okay.
C, if you're in public, you have foregone the reasonable expectation of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Or D, the pole-mounted camera fell on the county line and was out of the jurisdiction of federal authorities. So the question is, why did the Federal Circuit Court rule that no warrant was needed to watch Rocky Joe Houston from a camera mounted on a telephone pole near his house? And they did this for 10 months straight.
10 months. Joseph, any idea?
Oh, that's a tough one. My instinct is to say, go with C, that the filming was done in public and wouldn't be protected under conventional rights privacy.
So you didn't want to go with, like, A, the 11th month rule?
I don't know. Do I?
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
I'm going with my instinct.
You go with your instinct on this one. You didn't like the idea of domestic, you know, terrorist. I mean, he could, you know, Rocky Joe sounds to me kind of like a terrorist.
Could be. It could be, domestic
terrorist. Pretty formidable terrorist to have a name like that.
So I guess the question is, do you think that domestic terrorism laws account for the suspension of constitutional rights?
Yeah. You're not tempted by that one either. No, and you're not tempted by this county line.
Tempted.
No. The reason you're not tempted by those is because C is?
That is correct.
It's correct.
If you are in public, you have foregone the reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, this is an important case making its way through the courts.
It's a very important case, and it really goes to the heart of it. In fact, it's very interesting. A lot of search and seizure law, in fact, in some sense, virtually all of it, comes down to a single word. What is unreasonable?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's what the Fourth Amendment protects you against, is unreasonable searches and seizures. And so many, many millions of words have been devoted to trying to figure out what is unreasonable. And the courts have come up with a concept, as you say, Doug, the reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yeah. Do prosecutors need a warrant in order to watch you?
When you're in public.
Well, when you're in public.
Right.
This was 200 yards from the guy's house.
Right.
And they watched him for 10 months.
Well, the length of the surveillance
means nothing.
Well, it's not relevant in one sense, but in a gut level, gosh, you know, do we like the idea of the police just training cameras on our houses for extended periods of time? That gives people pause. It gives me pause. On the other hand, it's outdoors. And at any moment when you walk outdoors, do you have any expectation that whatever you do is out there is going to be private? I mean, we act differently outdoors than we do in our own homes. And that's the place where you have the strongest expectation of privacy, is within your own home.
Yeah, and that was Rocky Joe's problem, was that he kept going outside, and as a former felon, he had guns.
And he would take his guns out with him?
And he would take his guns out, and he was trading guns with friends, and he was walking, so that when the federal authorities, after 10 months, decided to go in, what they found was, you know, like 17 rifles, and, you know, he and his brother were trading guns, and...
Right.
You know, ultimately, this was a sting operation.
Right.
But because they only were able to gather that data and that information when they stepped outside with their guns.
Right. No expectation of privacy.
No expectation of privacy.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Doug. And thank you, Joseph. You got it right. You got it right. Your gut told you the right thing. So Jim Melcher must be teaching you up there, something up there at the University of Farmington at Maine. So
I'm glad I could make him proud.
Oh, I'm sure you have. In fact, I'm sure he's cheering in his office right now. And so, hi, Jim, and congratulations, Joseph. And please send us an email to ywc@montpelier.org, and send us your T-shirt size and your mailing address, and we'll have one in the mail to you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Thanks, Stuart. It's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. We've been talking about Brexit with William Walton, a law professor from the University of Northumbria. And we've talked a lot about the political fallout that's already occurred in the UK. But of course, that leaves one compelling question for us to address.
Well, what happens next? We've had this disarray. Theresa May is apparently going to become your new prime minister. Look in your crystal ball. What's going to happen? Is she going to invoke Article 50? Are we going to go on a two-year clock? Or is she going to start trying to negotiate with the Europeans? What's going to happen next?
Well, she said today in her press conference that Brexit means Brexit.
Mm-hmm. So even though she was opposed
she's
to
a it, Remain. She's a Remain.
She's a Remain, but, not a strong Remain, but not an open or, you know, particularly prominent Remain, but she was Remain. She's going to say, this is the will of the people. So she's going to do it. And let's talk about that for a moment. Now, and in fact, that's probably at the moment the single most salient constitutional issue that we've been hearing about over here, which is whether this is in fact just an advisory vote, whether Parliament has to follow it. As a matter of law or as a matter of practical politics? Could you comment on that, please?
Well, for a start, we don't, unlike your own country, we don't have many referenda. We don't, you know, you have your initiative and recall and referenda, particularly in the West, don't you? Mm-hmm. In California and Oregon and,
yes.
and Washington, they virtually live by these mechanisms. And in the United Kingdom, we're very strongly grounded in representative democracy rather than direct democracy. And in that way, we're quite different from Switzerland and Ireland, for example, where they have more referenda. We had a referendum in 1975 as to whether we should stay in the European Union. And that voted 2-1 in favour of remaining in the European Union, which we joined 3 years before. We've had referenda more recently on issues such as whether we should have mayors in individual cities, parking charges in London, congestion charging in London. But apart from those, we haven't had a referendum, to the best of my recollection, on a national policy issue since 1975. So they're not really part of our constitutional arrangement. That's the point I'm trying to come to. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the belief is, or the clear understanding is that the referendum we've just had is not binding. When we joined the European Economic Community, Parliament passed in 1972, I think it's called the European Communities Act. And essentially that said, European Union law, or European Economic Community law, is senior to, or it takes precedent over, incompatible UK law. And our membership has domestically always been based upon that piece of legislation. The Prime Minister can't repeal legislation by diktat. Only Parliament can repeal legislation. So for us to leave the European Union, we would have to repeal the European Communities Act of 1972, and Parliament would have to do that. So in other words, parliamentarians could actually say, we're not going to do that, notwithstanding what the referendum outcome was. It's unlikely, perhaps, but it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. Yes. Who knows? You know, we've after the last 2 weeks, to start making definitive statements as to what Parliament will do is silly.
Right. In more general terms, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that for centuries now, the concept of parliamentary supremacy has grown in importance, so that essentially you've got one body, Parliament, mm-hmm. Yep. Which effectively controls everything. That's why you can amend effectively your constitution simply by an act of Parliament. Unlike our Article 5 of the Constitution, which requires supermajorities both in Congress and in the states, via several different methods that might happen. But sure. That's prescribed, and it's supermajorities, and it takes years typically for a constitutional amendment to be ratified, if it's ratified, and we've only had 27 in our entire history.
And you've had roughly 11,000 attempts, haven't you?
Oh, lots and lots and lots. In fact, every year people introduce constitutional amendments, and they also do so at the state level. So if you count all of those, tens sure. of thousands. My point is this, is that Parliament is it in Britain, but this is not a parliamentary vote. This was a referendum, and so that's where the disconnection comes. On the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, there's generally an agreement that Parliament is ultimately beholden to the people. And so in a practical sense, if they don't vote for Brexit, they might find themselves out of a job within a couple of years here. But in a constitutional sense, I think, isn't there also a strong feeling that if the country has spoken, that Parliament may have a duty to go along with it?
Well, yes, I think you're right on everything you said there. We are a parliamentary. We do have parliamentary sovereignty. Although, again, as I said on your radio program about a year ago, in many ways that was undermined when the United Kingdom joined the European Economic Community because of the provision in the Act saying that essentially European law would take precedent to United Kingdom law. Mm-hmm. And many people on the left and the right who objected to the European Union over the last 30, 40 years have done so very often for reasons to do with the issue of parliamentary sovereignty being undermined. If you'd gone back 10 years, 10 or more years, the issue of immigration was just, it wouldn't have been recognised, wouldn't have been understood. There was no vast movement of labour across the European Union when the European Union comprised six or nine core economic states that had similar economies that operated at the same pace and the same scale. But it was only when the European Union expanded and took in the former Soviet states and the Balkan states and some of the Mediterranean states that you had this periphery of the European Union with very poor people that could suddenly move to the core states like Germany and the United Kingdom. And then suddenly this issue of labour migration became a big issue. But really, for many people, the objection over the last 30, 40 years has been a political sovereignty issue. And so this is a rather extended answer to your question. But yes, There is parliamentary sovereignty, but it has been somewhat undermined. But Parliament could refuse to go along with the referendum decision. But I also take the point that if it were to do that, there would be the potential for enormous resentment within the country. But having said that, bear in mind, the decision was 51.5 against 48.5. It's not as if it was 70-30. And there are many people, it's been said, that have voted out and didn't realise that out meant out. I'm embarrassed to say this as somebody speaking for the United Kingdom, because it implies that many of my fellow citizens were pretty stupid in the way they voted. But there were quite a lot who fell into that category, who bitterly resent now the fact that they voted out, because they treated it as a free hit. It was like a by-election for many people. I don't like David Cameron. I don't like the Conservative government. I'm fed up with politicians. It was a strong anti-politician vote. And it was probably people, you know, the same sentiments that you find with some of the supporters of Donald Trump. I mean, I'm not here trying to traduce Donald Trump or anything like that, but, you know, we see the coverage that we get coverage of Donald Trump's campaign, and we see many of the people there who support Donald Trump are probably embodied in many of the people who voted against membership of the European Union. They didn't like the political establishment. They didn't like politicians, and it was a free hit. And once the consequences were spelt out over the following days, you know, after the result, of what could happen, many of them said, "Oh goodness me, I never realized that would happen."
So this could just be they could have perceived it as a protest vote,
sure,
thinking that nothing would ever actually change.
Well, let me just give you a practical example. Just down the road from where I live, in Sunderland, the middle of Sunderland. Sunderland used to be a coal and shipping. They built ships for the world on the Weir, and all that's gone.
And this is in the northeast of England.
This is in the northeast of England,
right?
And about 15, 20 years ago, Nissan, the Japanese car manufacturer, built a plant in Sunderland. And it's the largest, I think it's the largest or the second largest car plant in Europe. And it's enormously important to the northeast of England in terms of its manufacturing base. It could close. Nissan have said that we'll have to look at what the agreement is in terms of duties, but most of the cars we make in the northeast of England are exported to Europe. And if we're suddenly out of the European Union and our car prices go up by 10%, as the suggestions they may do for duties on manufactured goods, well, we'll just move it to Slovakia or to Slovenia or to Germany. And those types of issues were not really discussed in any proper detail in the referendum campaign.
I've heard something.
There are people now who are saying, goodness me, I never knew that.
Yeah, and I've heard very much the same thing about London and the banking industry, which of course
could all go to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
If Scotland gets independence, maybe we'll come on to that.
Well, we'll get to that in just a moment, but I've heard that the banking sector in particular is one that is already – people are already talking about what the next London's going to be, and all the various cities are now putting in their bids. It could be Berlin. It could be Paris.
Yep.
It could be Amsterdam.
Yep.
It could be any place around there. So huge impact. But let me ask you, how true is that? That's certainly what we got. We got all those internet memes telling us that people were Googling what is the EU on the day after Brexit, which seemed to suggest that there had been enormous ignorance about this. Is that really your sense that that's true?
Well, it shouldn't be, because we had 4 or 5 months of being bombarded by advertisements and debates on television and on radio. But there are a lot of pretty ill-educated people in Britain, and the turnout was high, and a lot of the people who voted were perhaps not that well informed. So I think it's fair to say a lot of people voted on the issue of immigration. And I think, I know people in the Northeast who voted in the issue of immigration. I kind of distance myself from them in the sense that immigration in Northeast England isn't a huge issue. In certain parts of England, it was a big issue, Lincolnshire and parts of the Southeast. But it's difficult to know. It's the events are still too recent, really, to have any detailed analysis as to why people voted the way they did. But I think immigration is an issue which has commonly come up as being motivating people's.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're finishing up a second in a series of interviews with Bill Walton, William Walton, a law professor at the University of Northumbria in England, all about, oh my gosh, Brexit. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our interview with Bill Walton of the University of Northumbria in northeast England, all about Brexit. And before the break, we were talking about the motivations of the British public when they voted for this remarkable constitutional change. And among those motivations was immigration, a legitimate issue, but alongside the legitimacy, there were some darker motivations at play, it seems, as well.
You may have heard this, and it's very sad, again, embarrassing to say this, there's been quite a rise in hate crime directed at
EU citizens.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's actually, I've heard stories, one of them was rather notable, some fellow came up to a woman from Poland and, mm-hmm. and said to her, your lot will be out here shortly, we'll be kicking you out. And yep. this woman had lived there for 20 years or something, I think she owned a store.
And of course the rule is that anybody who's been here 5 years or more would be a UK citizen anyway, or would have a right and entitlement.
Right, she was a Polish heritage. Yeah,
sure.
But was
but there has again, I'd like to think that although there's been a significant rise, it was from a low base, so proportionately, we're still talking about something that's very, very at an absolute level, it's very insignificant, but it's embarrassing that it happens at all. And some of these incidents have been filmed. You know, people have had cameras and phones on buses, and there was a woman who got a lot of a mouthful on a bus, and it went on YouTube and went viral, and it was pretty awful to watch. So I think this issue of immigration, it would be, but as I said to you before, it would be wrong to dismiss it in terms of, I think there is a legitimate issue underneath it. Mm-hmm. I think, it's the same with the Donald Trump campaign. There is, I think, in a mature democracy, you have to be able to talk about immigration without being called a fascist or a racist. Mm-hmm. And maybe the problem with our political discussion at the moment in the United Kingdom is that it doesn't seem to be able to accommodate these issues. And perhaps that was brought forward by the referendum. Some people thought the referendum, well, this is the time I'm going to say what I want to. On this issue of referendum, on this issue of immigration, because parliamentarians won't allow me to say it the rest of the time because of political correctness, the establishment, and it's essentially, you know, Conservatives, Labour, once they get into parliament, they all broadly end up saying the same sorts of things. And this is a topic which is off limits. It's out of bounds. And, of course, the referendum gave them the opportunity to bring it back into play and to express their views on it. And that's what many of them did.
Well, a related concept to xenophobia as a motivating factor, as ignorance as a contributing factor, is the issue of misrepresentations. And I was also shocked by how very quickly many of the Brexiteers started backpedaling from the promises that they'd made. In fact, I think one in particular, perhaps it was Mr. Johnson, but correct me if I'm wrong.
So £350 million.
Right. Or was that Johnson or was that Farage who had been saying that the £350 million that were being sent every week off to Brussels were going to be immediately redirected to the National Health Service? Wasn't that the claim before the vote?
It wasn't. It wasn't. It was the official campaign. So it was Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. And on the side of their bus, they had a bus or a coach or a bus that they took around the whole of Britain campaigning in various areas. And written in big white letters on this red bus was £350 million a week that could be spent on the NHS, or wouldn't it be better spending on the NHS, which is the National Health Service, obviously, mm-hmm. for those listeners not familiar. In fairness, I think it was said in along the lines of, hypothetically, this is the sort of thing we could spend the money, which we now give to Europe as part of the weekly budget. Against that, you have the argument, actually, the figures were bogus. 350 million was the gross amount that was sent to Europe, but in net terms, once you took off the amount of money that then came back to the United Kingdom for regional grant assistance to places like the northeast of England and Wales, which again, we'll come on to the regional issues maybe in a minute, but South Wales voted heavily in favour of exit, and yet it's an enormous recipient of European regional assistance. But of course, the argument was led, well, we're just getting money back that we've already given to Europe. So we don't really consider that to be, you know, that's not the sort of assistance we want. We're capable of looking after ourselves. We don't need Europe to help us.
Right.
But you're right to say that almost immediately after the votes have been cast, the Brexit people were saying, well, what we meant by that was, you know, this money could go to the NHS, but it just depended upon the government of the day as to what they wanted to spend it on. The point is it's money that we would have in our UK budget to spend as we think appropriate, rather than Brussels telling us how to spend it through the European Union.
This is so reminiscent of a political debate in our nation. The regions of the country that receive the most in terms of federal subsidies are typically rural areas, predominantly southern areas, not exclusively. And those tend to be the same areas that are the most resentful of national government.
Sure.
And people point out that that's a bit of a disconnection. You know, why would you be so anti-national government? I think the argument is that we don't like being dependent on the national government and that we'd rather keep this money all in our state and take care of ourselves. But these are the same states in many cases that have a net benefit from being part of the national union. I mean, they, in effect, they can't subsidize themselves to the same extent that the national government is subsidizing them. And yet the resentment remains. So
Yes, we've had, as you know, I'm a sort of environmental lawyer by background. And the European Union has done things for the United Kingdom which, in the absence of the membership of the European Union, you wonder if UK governments would have done it, if that makes sense. So we've got clean air legislation, which has come through the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, we've been a member of the European Union for so long now, it's very difficult to, you know, this counterfactual issue, what would have happened if we'd not been a member? We don't know, because you've got to go back to 1970, 72. But nevertheless, there have been great benefits, I think, from membership of the European Union. For example, agency workers in Britain are now entitled to annual vacations or holiday allowances, which they didn't have before a European directive came through saying that must be done. A lot of our environmental legislation, cleaning waters and rivers and clean air, etc., has come through the European Union, and the UK government has had to transpose it into domestic legislation. Would that have happened had it not been for membership of the European Union? I don't know, but we weren't exactly one of the environmental progressives in Europe, so it's not unreasonable to say, probably not. So, and then on this issue of regional assistance, Wales and the Highlands of Scotland have received a lot of European Union grant funding. The Brexiteers say, well, that we would have had that money to spend on it in the absence of the European Union, but would it have happened? Or would that money have actually gone on tax cuts for the wealthy? And that's what you don't know, because it just depends upon what the priorities of the government have been for the day. But there wouldn't have been a sort of guarantee. European Union has been more left of centre than Britain, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been more willing to intervene in state market relations in the operation of the economy. And I think that's, again, why a lot of the resentment of the European Union has probably come from the right than from the left in Britain, because
right.
The European Union is seen as essentially, Mrs. Thatcher said famously, I didn't kick out socialism in Britain to see it. I didn't kick out socialism in the United Kingdom to see it reintroduced through the back door by the European Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one can understand that. I mean, it might just simply be a different political perspective. And if you're a person who lives in Britain or in any of the other EU countries and you tend to be more on the political right and you perceive the people in Brussels as being more on the political left, that's another reason to disassociate yourself, I suppose. But
yes,
given all of this, given the apparent ignorance of at least some people when they cast their votes, given at least some of the misrepresentations or, shall we say, overstatements that were revealed in the immediate aftermath of Brexit, given the concerns about xenophobia and perhaps even racism in some circumstances, what are the chances of a second referendum? Could we have a second Brexit vote?
Well, it may come down to the issue as to what terms and conditions are agreed upon. This is a process that, notwithstanding the formal two-year process that's contained in Article 50, it may take much longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
And one could imagine a situation in 4, 5, 6, 7 years' time where, after much negotiation, a prime minister comes back to the United Kingdom and says, well, we've got a divorce deal. And the divorce deal is as follows. We get access to the single European market. We get access to this 550 million people market, which is fantastic. But in return, we're going to have to accept quite a lot of free movement of labor. We're not going to be able to impose our own immigration limits as we want to. We're going to have to, I don't know, let's say a figure. They may say 100,000 a year, something like that. And we're also going to have to accept some of this European red tape that we've just been talking about, some of these regulations that interference in the economy. And we're also going to have to pay £200 million a week to the European budget. What do you say to that? And many people may turn around and say, no, that's not what I voted for
that's interesting.
2016.
So you're saying a second referendum may arise organically from the process of negotiation?
Well, either that, or I think what is perhaps more likely is it then the Brexit process becomes part of the political process in Britain. By what I mean to say that is a political party will put something in its manifesto before, let's say, the 2020 general election, assuming that that's when we have our next general election, which is when we're scheduled to have it. It may be that by 2020, we'll know what the political terrain is. And Labour will go into that election saying, we're in favour of either remaining in the European Union, or if we come out, it's on these terms. Mm-hmm. The Conservatives will say something different. And then it gets, as I say, it gets incorporated into the dialogue of UK politics rather than through a referendum. And it could then be that essentially an election result could take precedent or priority over the referendum result.
Well, that's something I hadn't really thought about, is that as broadly as this referendum was worded, you know, basically leave or remain.
Or stay, yeah.
Yeah, that still leaves a host of questions to be answered, and someone has to answer them. And so whether it's a parliamentary vote or whether there's a second referendum or a third or a fourth or a fifth, there are going to be decisions that must be made in the future. And depending on how those decisions are made, if as you say, the divorce agreement simply doesn't meet with the approval of the British electorate, that could effectively negate the British referendum. The Brexit referendum.
It could do. And this goes back to the issue that the referendum essentially was just on this simple question of yes or no, whereas life is more complicated than that. And the answer for many people is no but, or yes but.
In fact,
you can't put that through a referendum. A referendum is not a great mechanism for resolving complex questions.
It's really not. And in fact, I think that the divorce analogy is a very, very good one, because you might ask an unhappy couple on a given day when they're particularly unhappy, you know, should we get divorced or not? And they might both say, yes, let's get a divorce. But then reality hits. Okay, who gets the house? Who gets custody of the kids?
Sure.
You know, is there really no chance at reconciliation? Mm-hmm. All the rest of these issues come up, and many couples who begin divorce proceedings then ultimately reconcile. And I wonder if that might happen here.
It may do. I'm stuck for words here because it's so difficult to, as I say, to speculate now as to what will happen in a few years' time. But I do think it will become incorporated into our political process. We're seeing the Labour Party at the moment. There is possibility of a dissolution almost of the Labour Party.
Let's talk more about that. You mentioned before
the Lib Dems have virtually disappeared, although their membership has taken a positive bounce since the outvote. Many people have now said, actually, I'd like to be a member of a party who are passionately in favour of the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
But it does raise the question as to whether within the British political spectrum there is the opportunity now for a realignment of British politics, allowing a new party to come to the fore who are explicitly in favour of membership of the European Union. And that would essentially become their raison d'etre, in much the same way that the Scottish National Party in Scotland, their raison d'etre is dissolution of the Union.
Right.
And the same for Plaid Cymru in Wales, the Welsh Nationalists. Their reason for existence is to get Wales out of the United Kingdom.
We'll get to Scotland and Wales in just a minute.
Sure. But could we have a political party in Britain who say, right, we're not going to shilly-shally on this issue. I hope that's an expression that's understood in America. We're not going to equivocate.
We do a lot of shilly-shallying over here.
We're going to be passionately in favour of membership of the European Union. And if you vote for us, that's what you'll get. And it's difficult to say at the moment, but the Labour Party are in the process of shooting themselves in the foot. You have two parties, essentially. You have a parliamentary party and you have the membership. And the membership...
The elites and the common folk. All right. Well, we're just about out of time. So grand summation. What is going on over there? What is going to happen over the next few months?
Well, it's very, very difficult to say. Look, Theresa May will be Prime Minister on Wednesday. She's got to see the Queen, apparently, and David Cameron's got to pop along and see Liz and say goodbye to her formally. And then Theresa's
also known as the Queen.
Liz, the Queen. Yes, yeah. Yes. And sorry, I didn't want to be disrespectful. And so we'll have a Conservative government carrying on, because, of course, in Britain we elect the party and the party elects the leader who becomes a prime minister. So technically you don't need to dissolve Parliament, as we've discussed that. Labour's infighting will continue, and the European Union, the leaders of the European Union, are probably going to say, sorry, come on, you've got to speed this process up, because you either get on with it or you don't do it at all. And I think Theresa May is going to be spending a lot of the next 2 years negotiating very hard with leaders of the European Union over the terms and conditions of Britain's withdrawal. And the test, you know, the proof will be in the pudding, or whatever the expression is, that we'll have to find out as to how acceptable those terms and conditions are, because that's the issue. We're taking this leap into the unknown when we voted to exit, because we just don't know what the European Union are going to say, because this is uncharted waters. The European Union may say, yeah, you can withdraw, that's up to you, but these are the terms and conditions and they're not going to be very favourable to you. Take it or leave it. And, you know, at some point, the Prime Minister is going to have to come back to the British people, either, as I say, in a general election through a manifesto, or possibly through a second referendum.
Well,
and say, do you like this or not?
I certainly wish you well in these difficult times, and I will simply take a moment to express my confidence that, to borrow a phrase, I'm sure that you will keep calm and carry on. Thank you very much, Bill Walton of the University of Northumbria's Law School. We really do appreciate your time. And
it's great to speak to you. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the Anglo-American constitutional experiment.